This is class number 3 of the North Battleford Ecclesial March 2018 Study Weekend. The general theme of the series is covetousness, and the title for this class is All That Is in the World. Your opening reading was 1 John chapter 2. I will now call upon our brother Frank to lead us in this third class. Brother Frank.
Well, brothers and sisters and young people, as we mentioned in our last class, we'd like to actually deal with a few of the practical issues relating to the classes that we've had, things that may have a little bit more application to everyday life. And what I'd like to do first is just look at a few principles that we have that we will need to remember as we go through this. One of them is found in this chapter we just read. So if you'd look at the chapter, 1 John chapter 2, and look at verse 15, you'll notice something that is very familiar to us, where it says, "Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world passeth away, and the lust thereof. But he that doeth the will of God abideth forever." Now the word lust, in every case, is the word epithumia, which means a longing. So it's the longing of the flesh. Things that you really find in your mind you want for, or you want. Now sometimes it's not very easy to tell in your own mind what it is that, what part of your mind is actually coming up with these thoughts. Like sometimes it may be just the fleshly part of your mind that's saying yes. It may be the spiritual part of your mind that's saying yes. Because we know that the carnal mind and the spiritual mind are at enmity one with another. And you cannot make the carnal mind obey God. It cannot be made to do so. So you really have to do a little thinking in your own mind. Like what is it that I'm hearing? Is it the longing of the flesh that's what's seeking this, or is it something to do with the Spirit of God, something that I've learned from His Word? And it may not be very obvious to you, and you have to really do some investigation as to how it really is coming. I just think with the deceitfulness of the mind that very often we can be fooled into thinking that this is a useful thing or that we could make it useful without really analyzing it properly. How much of a benefit it is to have somebody who's close to you who you can use as a bit of a sounding board. You know, have a relationship with your spouse that you can talk about these things. Have a relationship with your parents that you can talk about things. And be able to just see what is going on in their mind. Sister Dorothy and I had difficulty with some of our children and not being open enough with us. We really didn't know what they were thinking, and that is not pleasant for a parent to not be able to know what their child is thinking. So it seems to me that we have to find times when we can help one another in what we're wrestling with. Another one is Luke chapter 8. This is another very familiar passage where we look at the parable of the sower. But I think a lot of us would agree that in the last few years, we have been wrestling more with thorns and thistles than we ever have at any other time of our life. So in Luke 8, verse 14, we read, is it possible to get that on, Joey? I don't know whether it's just a matter of turning it on or not. Okay. So in Luke chapter 8, verse 14, "That which fell among the thorns are they which, when they have heard, go forth and are choked with the cares and riches and pleasures of this life and bring no fruit to perfection." If you've never gardened, if you've never seen this in the natural, you probably wouldn't have any feeling for what the Lord is telling us here. And it can be done just as simply as going out into a piece of ground and putting in a few good seeds and putting in a few weed seeds and see how they fare. And we have found that out in Book Road, because we have a little space at the back of Book Road, which was a berm of earth that they had moved when they put on the new wing. And they just built it up, and it just went immediately to weeds. There was hundreds of very noxious weeds growing, big thistles. I never saw them really so big as they were. And they just flooded the whole area with seeds. So from my farming background, that's one thing that you tried to let not happen. You're like, you really were much against weeds seeding down like that, because you knew what you're going to have to battle you're going to have later on. So we made it into a garden and tried to illustrate to the children just the difference between this. We had them out all planting in the garden, and if you didn't weed, it would eventually be that those weeds, you wouldn't even be able to find the good plants. They just override it in one summer. Just leave it alone and let's see what happens. Now, if you've seen that in a natural garden, and if all the more, if you've actually sown the seeds and saw what happened, you have a little more feeling about it. When you read that and it says, the seed that fell among thorns are those that the weeds are choking them, and hence the cares and the riches and the pleasures of this life, they bring no fruit to perfection. Now, what are the cares? What are the riches? What are the pleasures of this life that choke out the truth? Well, I would hope it would never happen with the Christadelphian group, but if you read the average amount of time that people spend with their cell phones or with their entertainment, their electronic entertainment, it's scary to see how many hours a week people actually use it. And what you need to do sometime, even if you only do it once in your life, is to try to record for a week how you spend your time and actually make a log of it. This is what I did today. This is what I did this day. This is what I did this day. And just try to find out how much time you waste, because that's what this is. It's being choked by the cares and the riches and the pleasures of this life that just don't allow it to have the time to prosper. And so we have to look carefully at it, but we have to invest in it to see it that way. We can get this to work now. There we are. So we've been through that one. This is the one we're looking at. So this can happen by default. You just leave it alone. That's the way it'll work out. Without a very conscious effort to put our time and energy and resources into the work of the truth, the weeds will easily outgrow the more important things. You've really got to invest in that. So as a community, we need help in this matter. And I think in a lot of cases, we just need to be a little more honest with ourselves as to where our time is going. We spoke about this next one, and that is the need for self-discipline. Everybody needs to help have self-discipline. Doesn't matter who we are, it doesn't matter how old we are, you always need to maintain health, self-discipline. And the proverb says, he that hath no rule over his own spirit or no self-discipline is like a city broken down without walls. You're defenseless. Which means that when you get on the internet, you're defenseless. And you just can't schedule your time. You have a very difficult time disengaging. So you just keep on it and wasting your time. You know, you're trying to find a bargain. So you get on there, and if you just kept track of the time it takes to find something like that, is it worth shopping on the internet for a half hour to find something that is the cheapest price so you save 50 cents? Is it worth it? You gotta look at life like that if you really want to discipline ourselves to not be subject to this thing, I think, that affects us all. So it's nigh impossible to deal with covetousness if we do not have a good measure of self-discipline. We need to be able to say no to a thought and redirect our attention thereby. Now, I don't think we've, in today's world, that anybody would mind if you saw a person walking down the aisle saying no. And you think, well, he's not talking to anybody. There's so many people walking down with something and they're talking away, and you sort of think that's just the way it is. But it was really funny to see that when that first started off, when people actually had these cell phones and they could speak to somebody and they could conduct business. especially at the airports. You see these people walking around in circles and they're talking, but they're not talking to anybody until you get used to it. And then it's just the way people are. We need to always recognize this too, because in a lot of cases, that's not recognized. In James 4, verses 13 to 15, go to now, you that say today or tomorrow, we will go into such a city and continue there for a year and buy and sell and get gain. Whereas you know not what shall be on the morrow, for what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. For that you ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that. So you see, there's this little picture here of what is your life? It's a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. So you need to see how little time a vapor lasts. So if you watch a kettle boil, for instance, you see a vapor, it's gone. Quite often it's like looking out one minute, you see a fog there, and then a few minutes later, because of the sun, it's dissipated, it's gone, or it's lifted. So yeah, that's what life is like. And the Bible's just full of these little pictures of what our life is like. It just comes and it goes and it's gone. So yes, we ought to say, if the Lord will, we will live and do this or that. And we have learned through experience to go to the meeting always asking God's blessing before we go. Because I imagine, just like out here, we have to travel about 40 minutes to get to the meeting on a high-speed highway with a lot of traffic. And there's so many accidents happen today, you just need to ask for God's care all the time. Make it a habit. And then in this final preparation, you know that in the temptation of the Lord, the devil said to him, if thou be the Son of God, command this stone that it be made bread. And how did Jesus handle it? He handled it by saying, it is written that man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word of God. Now, that's hard to do, very, very difficult for anyone at any stage to be able to answer every temptation with a written scripture. But that's really what we need to do. We need to get good at that. We need to try to practice it that way. The Lord's reaction to temptation was made possible by a commitment to know, understand, and remember the word of God. We are directed to take up our cross and follow him in that respect. So what we'd like to do is look at 12 areas where the snares of covetousness can be found. It's not exhaustive. I wanted to make you sure of that. Like, you may think of many other areas. I wouldn't think maybe be many other areas, but you would certainly think of other areas. This is not intended to be exhaustive. It's just intended to be an example of where the snares of covetousness are lurking. So we want to look at credit. We want to look at keeping up. We want to look at impulsive buying. We want to look at investments. We want to look at two incomes. We want to look at pleasure seeking, at entertainment, at surfing the web, at education, at protection, at lotteries, and at opinion. Now, you wouldn't know necessarily what I mean by a couple of those, but that's the areas. I've sort of looked at this subject, and I thought, you know, the best thing would be to do after having done this study is to try to see where I would think, if I wanted to change something in my life or I wanted to draw attention to a problem area, I would look at these practical areas and categorize it. So if you look at the one, the improper use of credit. Now, you have to understand the use of credit and debit. So some of us may have a debit card and some of us may have a credit card or two. A debit card means you've got money in the bank. You can go in and you can use that debit card and it comes directly out of your bank. So there is no credit involved. When you make a transaction, you're paying. But you're not paying with dollars or money up front. You're paying on that debit card. It's just electronically. It can be taken right out of your bank. So a debit card is a good idea. And for people who have trouble with credit, who misuse the use of a credit card, they should cut up their credit cards and only use a debit card. A failure to do that can really get you into problems. So buying things we want but do not need on a credit account because we do not have sufficient money to pay for it. Now, you have to understand all of the criteria there. It's buying things. You're committing to buy it. Things that we want but do not need. So that's a little area where if you put it in your cart, you really think that you want this. You have a little opportunity, like God makes a way of escape. Remember we talked about that? He'll give you a way of escape. You have a little time while you're carrying that in your cart to the counter to really think, do I need this? Do I need this? And I don't know about you, but there are some times when I thought, like, I don't really need this. I shouldn't have picked this up and take it back, put it on the shelf. Just because you need to have that second thought about whether you really need it. And if you're going to buy it on a credit account, that's another issue again. I think having a credit card is quite all right if you use it properly, because in many cases you can't do business if you don't have a credit card. They won't take anything else except a credit card. That's just the way we are today. But if you don't have sufficient money to pay for it, that's different. That is stepping over a line. Or when we only pay the minimum balance instead of the whole balance on a credit account. So really, you're no real good sort of a clientele for a credit account if you pay it the whole balance at the time they ask you to pay it, because they don't make much money on you. But they will make a lot of money on you if you pay the minimum balance, because you're paying a huge amount of interest. And if you only considered your interest, I'll tell you, you would reconsider it. That's one thing I always did for my students day one of school. I said to them, a lot of you students will be coming here on a student loan. Okay, so there's this student loan thing in the province of Ontario, and students come and they have the money. But what I was seeing was every single class, these students come in with these big Tim Hortons cups of coffee. Now, they're not cheap. And they usually, because they're hungry, they have something to eat with it. And I know what that costs. And this is not lunch. This is just something because it's math class. And they think they need that to get through it. So I had to tell them, you've got to realize, if you're using your credit to buy Tim Hortons coffee, you want to think about how you're going to pay this back. Because when you've got, say, $5,000 loan, and you got it in your bank account, you might think, hey, I got a lot of money. I can live pretty good on this. But someday you have to pay it back. So I said, now, this is only one semester. You got six semesters here. So multiply that by six and see how much money you're going to owe at the end. And after you get a job, they want you to start paying for it. Now, let's say you borrowed $20,000. After it all, you had $20,000 of debt when you got out of school. And then you said, well, I really can't just pay that off. So I'm going to commit myself to pay, say, $100 a month or something like that. Well, I can't be sure that was the number I'd choose, but it was something like that. It was a fairly low amount, because I said, you know, when you get out of school, you're going to get a job. You're going to need a car. More than likely, you'll need a car. You might even be thinking of getting married and having a house and all the rest of it. He said, everything comes at that time. So you won't be wanting to spend a lot on your student loan. So I said, do you know how long it will take you to pay your student loan off at about $100 a month? And they had no idea. And I said, when your kids are in college, you'll still be paying your loan off. A lot of these young men, they're shaking their heads, you know, oh, well, you know, that sounds kind of cool. Let's get on to school, on to the work. It just went right over them. But that is the fact, that if you really sat down and worked it out, you're paying a minimum balance. It's unreasonable to see how much you're, it's reasonable to do it, but it's unreasonable the amount of money they're asking you to pay. This Psalm 19 is worth memorizing. And I would really encourage people to memorize Psalms like this. This verse, or these verses around verse 19 or verse 13 are very useful. It says, keep back thy servant from presumption. Just doing things, thinking everything's going to be okay without ever thinking it through. From presumptuous sins, let them not have dominion over me. Then shall I be upright, and I shall be innocent from the great transgression. The idea of getting into some contract or some financial arrangement where you don't even think about how you're going to pay it back is just not right. That's not something that we should be doing, and it's an improper use of credit. But in today's world, it's encouraged, and so many people do it. People think, well, let's just do what everybody else, they seem to do it, get by. Keeping up with the latest. Now, you know what I mean by that. That's so much of a problem today that it costs a lot of money to keep up. And this has led to unique problems in this covetous age. We spend a lot of money just to keep up. As I was telling the young people the other night, it cost me a lot of money when I started a business just at the time the wave of technology on computers was also starting. So not only did I have to pay for the computers, which had to be fairly good computers to do what I was doing with them, but I also had to pay for education to know how to operate them with these advanced software that I was using to do what I was doing. But within 10 years of operating that, it was obsolete. The software had changed. The hardware had so greatly improved. It took so much or so less time to do things if you had that all this stuff really became obsolete. Here I had $30,000 worth of equipment that I dumped in a dumpster because it all worked, but it was useless. No one wanted it. And I had to keep up in order to keep up in the business. I suppose that there are a number of people that are in business know what that means. And if you don't keep up, you don't have the business. But many of us have got nothing to do with business. We just want the latest. So sometimes it's just a matter of pride. And we live in a very wasteful society. Well, that's, I think, an outcropping of what it says in Daniel 12:4. That knowledge would be increased. Now, we mentioned that in the lecture. Can you imagine, you know, as we said that night, how can you imagine all of the knowledge that men have ever accumulated is doubling right now at about every 13 months? And they expect it will, in the foreseeable time, double every 12 hours. That's you're hardly able to imagine that. That all the information that's ever been accumulated will be doubling that fast. And that's because of how people are using information today. You know, people want data on this and they want this investigated and they want, you know, probes on this and getting data from that. And all that goes into measurements that are recorded and restored, put on a file somewhere. Well, that's the mushroom. That's what's making this so, it would seem, just out of control. Keeping up with the latest is very costly. And to keep doing that is probably a real waste of money. Unless, again, you're in business and you have no choice. Buying on impulse. Now, I didn't know this until I did a little study on how people who are working in business actually put a store together so they can take advantage of people who buy an impulse. So there's the doorway. Say, so what do we put in front of the doorway? The first thing that people see when they come into our store is probably something they don't need. But it doesn't cost that much. And, it could be used at some time. Or it could be that, you know, here's a package of 10 of them that if you looked out in the price, the unit price is so much less than what you would pay otherwise. How can I afford not to buy this? So you didn't only come down there to buy one, come to buy 10, but you went out with 10 because it was a bargain. Like this impulse buy, making your decision when you come to the store is the way people are meeting us in the store. They're set up to encourage buying on impulse. This includes buying more of a product than we really need, and sometimes the store price is below their cost. Like when they're trying to compete with other stores or trying to impress you, they will put certain products on there that you will never find a better price than that, but they can't make any money on it either, except that it's long-range planning. If they can get you back to think that's a great store, well, that's good. So one needs to make a list and stick to it. How many of you actually make a list when you go to shopping and stick to it? Anybody? Does anybody go shopping? Like, there are some people that must go through their kitchen and say, look, I need this, I've made this list, and when you go there, you only come back with what's on that list. But you know what I mean when you see the impulse buying. You go in there and you didn't realize that would be such a good buy on this product, so you end up buying it. Well, that's what people are being encouraged to do, and you can see that the store will eventually win. They cannot stay in business and lose money. Okay, so stores like Target, etc., that were actually losing money, eventually they fall off the side and they're done. They're out of there. So Matthew chapter 6, verse 33, verse 34, sometimes maybe should be attached to the shopping list. But seek you first the kingdom of God and its righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. Take therefore no anxious thought for the morrow. You have to think for the morrow, but to be concerned about it, overly concerned about it. The morrow will take thought for the things of itself. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. Now, young people maybe not appreciate this unless their parents are victims of it and they see it around the home, but almost everybody has got a lot more things than they need. And when Dorothy and I downsized from the farm, I made hundreds of dollars on scrap metal. His old engines, old balers, parts of tractors, and boxes of bolts and things all went for scrap iron. We didn't realize how much money we had sitting around there in just scrap iron. But then the things that I had stored up in the barn that I thought one day I would need, you know, it all had to go. It was a nightmare. I think I had about 16 bonfires, big bonfires, up beside the barn to get rid of it all because no one else is going to want the stuff, and I sure wasn't going to take it to the city where we went. So, yeah, we do have more, much more stuff. You know, a good thing to do would be sometimes just have a garage sale and get rid of some of that stuff and give it to an ecclesial function to do some good. Rather than just hoard this stuff that we bought an impulse and we did use one, but we don't know what to do with the other nine. Investments. Well, there are many scams in this world seeking out those who desire to be rich. Do you think the Christadelphians can be involved in scams? Now, we happen to know some that have been involved. They have been taken advantage of by the fact that someone got on the phone and talked to them into spending some money, not right away, but over a longer period of time. It's just total scam. Just took their money, and they had nothing to show for it. Like, why would you be a victim of someone talking you into an investment without really investigating it? Or getting someone else in the ecclesia to look at it and to help you think through it that's not so related to it. With what we know is coming, worldly wealth is not a good investment. Like, if we knew for sure, and I tried this out once just as a little experiment with myself. I went to my calendar on one particular year, and I just sort of randomly went and I circled one day. I said to myself, that's the day the Lord's coming. I didn't believe it was the day of the Lord's coming. I just did it to see what kind of an effect it would have on my thinking if I believed it just for the sake of seeing what I would do. So you get close to this day and I say, well, you know, that's only 3 weeks away. The Lord's coming in 3 weeks. Would I go out and make an investment in 3 weeks? No, I wouldn't. You'll never see any return on the investment. It would be silly to think that. Well, what's the difference between brethren and sisters who, when they go to a public lecture, tell the public the Lord's coming soon and hear all the signs, and then go out and sign an investment that has a 10-year return or something on it? So you have to live consistently with that. Not to live consistently with it is to show the hypocrisy which drives people away from the truth. Like, we have to be consistent with what we're saying. If we don't believe that if we do believe that the Lord is coming, we should be living so that we don't be involved in things that are long term, where really, yeah, our treasure's laid up somewhere in a bank, but it's not in heaven with the Lord, where He will reward us at His coming. So lay up treasure with the Lord, where it's secure and dividends will be paid, and that's reflected in Matthew chapter 6, 19 to 21. Lay not up for yourselves treasures upon earth, where moth and rust doth corrupt, where thieves break through and steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. I just think that, and you know, don't think that I've got my life in act and totally in keeping with all this. Like I'm putting these things on because in my study I can see this. It doesn't mean to say that I've got my act together in all this. There's still a few things I have I should get rid of. You know, things that I've been keeping because I thought maybe one day it would be a little more valuable than it is right now. What do you do then? Okay, the people have had stamp collections. And they thought, well, you know, one day that stamp collection is going to be worth some money. Some people save cards, sports cards and things like that. And they were worth a lot of money for people who did keep them. But why do we invest in things like that? Is that laying up a reward with the Lord? Does the Lord look upon that as a treasure? Or is that the investment which is just in the world itself, laying up treasure for yourselves upon earth? So that's the kind of thing, thoughts I had on investments. And people who have investments may have other thoughts about that I haven't perceived or thought about myself. Now this one is a bit of a problem. I don't know if it'd be a problem out here or not, but it certainly is back home because it's very difficult to buy into Hamilton area. Or anybody that's starting off a house, it is so expensive to buy in there that even people who already have a house can't really afford to upgrade to a house there because the price of a house and land in there is way out of proportion to what it's really worth. So people go for two incomes. So starting off in marriage, you thought, well, you know, we could have the husband working and he's looking after that part of it, and the sister-wife could be doing something else, but not a career income. But when you commit yourself to expectations which are too high, we need to lower our costs, not to get two incomes. So sometimes we try too fast to track life and put off, say, having a family. Or a working mother will not be able to provide as well as one who is always at home for the family. We don't think of those ideas. We don't prioritize them. We just think of, this is what mom and dad have. Why can't I have it? And the world's with you. And special bargains for first-time homeowners. So if you really want to look around, you can maybe find a bargain somewhere. But never, ever think when you're making a business deal that someone's not interested in making money for the company they represent. If it seems to be a bargain for you and it makes money for them, that's unusual. It may just appear to be a bargain for you, but it makes money for them or they're not going to stay in business. So what might seem to be cheap is still a money venture for them. And I thought it's a very, very wise proverb. Proverbs 32, verse 8 and 9. Remove far from me vanity and lies. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with food convenient for me, lest I be full and deny thee and say, who is Yahweh? Or lest I be poor and steal and take the name of my God in vain. So you see the poverty side and you see the wealthy side. And the best position is to be somewhere in between. And the wisdom of the word is it doesn't tell us where to be in between. It's just those extremes are where the trouble comes. But we have seen people who, because their parents had this and their parents had that, wanted to have the same thing. So a lot of people started off living with their parents. A lot of people started off renting. Dorothy and I didn't live with our parents, but we started off renting. And we've rented for quite a long time. We just believe that, you know, there's nothing wrong with renting. A lot of people look at it as an investment. Well, it depends how you think about your philosophy of life. As they say, your worldview. If you really believe Jesus is coming back soon, if you really believe that we don't have any, you know, place we can say this is our home, we're strangers and sojourners in this world, then why would we want to buy something that puts us permanently in a place? And hence, we have backed off that idea of investment and that rush to get it. I don't know if that we could say that is pure. There could be a few other ideas involved as well, but that's essentially the philosophy behind it. Pleasure seeking, well, I'm afraid that this is becoming a bigger issue because of gaming. Does anybody understand what I mean by gaming? Yeah, I think so. And there may be some people who are a victim of gaming, that they can't get away from the gaming. They become so addicted to playing games on the computer that they've got very good at it, and they just can't leave it alone. And as a result, they would understand the idea of the addiction. Borderline between what is relaxing and what is pleasure can be very difficult to define, so I'm not going to go into that one. But great pleasure can be found in the work of the truth. If you're really looking for pleasure, all I can say is some of the greatest joy you'll ever have, meaningful joy, where you really understand what joy is, would be doing some work in the ecclesia. Now you see, being Americans, or North Americans anyway, is that the problem with us very often is we're too independent. We like to maintain our independence. Even a family, we like to maintain our independence. We like to be able to maintain our independence. We like to be able to be financially independent. But you know, there's some real pleasure in being dependent. There's some real pleasure in working together and not being so independent in spirit. So, you know, we know a little bit about each other's life, and we can work together to help one another instead of, you know, well, that's my business and that's where I am and that's what I'm doing. I just think there's a great pleasure in being a fellow servant. We're not a servant alone. The word's used often in the scriptures, it's a fellow servant. Our fellowship is being servants. But our fellowship being servants has to have some body to it. It can't be just we listen to talks and we give an intellectual assent. That's what we like to do. We've actually got to show how we live that. So ecclesial activities, which we develop together, I don't necessarily think they have to be directed to pleasure seeking, but even, you know, going camping together or something like that is things that build together, and they can be great pleasure. Certainly, I think gaming is a problem that's going to get worse and worse. And I guess one of the worst things about gaming is that the games that people play are quite often very violent. And the way people can keep track of what you're doing on the internet now is a bit scary as well, because often you're doing something internet and then you get a message. You say, well, how did they ever know I was doing that? I was just doing something, and here I get this message about to do it, and I never asked for it. It's because you're being monitored. So people would know you're gaming. They know what games you're playing. How could you go to a judge and say, look, I don't believe in violence? And he's able to say to you, but yeah, but your record illustrates that you've been playing all these violent games. What do you mean you don't believe in violence? There has to be a coordination between our lifestyle and what we believe. And today it's really unusual that that could be monitored by other people, but that's quite true. So we are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, and holy nation, a peculiar people, that we should show forth the praises of him who hath called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. And if we can think of those kinds of thoughts, we still have pleasure, but it's controlled pleasure, and it's not joining the world in that pleasure. Entertainment, well, most of the entertainment of this world involves such violence, immorality, evil, as to be totally unsuitable for brethren of Christ. Once witnessed, the mind keeps it in memory and comes back at most inconvenient times. That's what I was mentioning a little bit earlier. I try not to turn on any news items on Sunday morning. I try to just keep my mind free of even the news or anything. Just come to the meeting without any worldly influence, just for the sake of trying to control our minds at the memorial table. Have you ever had the problem of controlling your mind at the memorial table? You know, and a brother gets up to pray for the bread and pray for the wine, you don't remember a word he said. Your mind wasn't with the person at all. Well, did you really ever then say a prayer? Like, we can't treat God like that. God knows exactly what's happening, and he does not accept that kind of behavior. So whatever we have to do, we have to do it. And if entertainment the night before is what's influencing. We want to be really careful in that. I was, and I think maybe a few of you, always very impressed with hockey. You know, you want to know how your hockey team's doing, and you want to check the scores, and you may even be watching hockey. I don't know. But can you get it out of your mind at your own will? Can you just turn it off? Or can you find that, if you've actually watched it, and in today's world of watching something, you show it again and again and again so you can see exactly how the goal was scored or how the man saved the occasion, and it comes back to haunt you. Well, you know, enough of that is enough. Like when you see that's happening and it's interfering with your spiritual time and you don't really like what's happening, you've got to shut it down. So we've got to do this. And the worst part of it is it's hard to do because you can remember things. I can remember hockey games with Foster Hewitt. Can anyone remember him? Foster Hewitt? A few older people around. He was the announcer that was so famous that he could make a radio broadcast of a hockey game sound like you were watching it. He was so good at what he said. And I grew up as a boy listening to Foster Hewitt announce the games of hockey on Saturday night. I can still remember them. I can still hear them. I can still hear how he says he shoots, he scores. You know, and when you're playing international hockey, Canada with Russia or something like that, you don't forget those things. If he could only make the truth have that impression upon our minds. So we couldn't forget these things, but go and we always think about them. If they come and they stop us at work because here we are doing something at work and we're thinking about some chapter in the Bible, that would be rare. Unless we had a talk to give that night. And then they'd be pressured into it. So entertainment, we've got to be very careful with that. Take heed to yourselves, lest at any time your hearts be overcharged with surfeiting and drunkenness and cares of this life, and so that day come upon you unawares. Well, it could very well come upon us unawares if we're involved in those kinds of things. The internet, well, there was a brother who said he bought a new television and he was going to install it in his house, but when he saw an advertisement on the outside of the box that this is the way to bring the world into your home, he decided that maybe this wouldn't have been such a good idea. He sent it back. See, it's a way to escape. You get out of it. Wouldn't it be wonderful if that's the way our minds work? That we see something and all of a sudden, what am I doing? Why would I want the world to come into my life? Well, the internet does that exactly. And it brings the worst of the world into your life. I have no idea how they managed to do it, but certain things, they just come on your screen, they flash on your screen. I didn't turn this on to see that, but it comes on anyway. And if you try to click it off, there's something there that clicks into something else you didn't want on your screen. And people seem to be setting it up just to capture your imagination and your time. We don't want that, brothers and sisters. We don't want to do that, but that's what the internet is. And now with all this false news, you just sort of wonder where this is going. So never before has the sin of covetousness been so easy to commit with the internet. So you can buy, you can check out things, you can surf the net, see all the different ways in which it can be used. It just takes time. It takes our thoughts. It takes our energy like nothing else. It's a real sink on our time. We don't want to go down that road. This form of the media has great possibilities for good and great potential for evil, as almost everything that man's invented has. But in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, it tells us, "Come out from among them, be separate, saith the Lord. Touch not the unclean thing, and I will receive you, and will be a father unto you, and you shall be my sons and daughters, saith the Lord Almighty." So you can see how important it is, brothers and sisters, when we come together to talk of the truth. You know, just think of the times we come together and whether when we're together, we're talking about the weather or talking about, you know, the price of something in the world market. We're talking about something that, you know, it's related to the province in which we live. But we're not talking about the truth. Now, there can be no advantage of us coming together. And when the Apostle Paul says, forsake not the assembling of yourselves together, it wasn't just because we assemble together. We go home and say, well, I was together with the brethren. It's what did we talk about? How did we help each other? What was our conversation? Where did it lead? And, you know, we've got to watch ourselves because normally it doesn't go the way of the truth. We've got to be separate and dedicated to God's calling. Education, well, before I left education, we were telling our students, you've got to think of your education as never finishing in today's world. Because knowledge is growing so fast. This is not coming out of the Word of God. This is coming out of the colleges of Ontario, saying knowledge is increasing so fast, you will never be finished your education. You've got to learn to live in a world where once you're finished your education, you've got to go back again and again and again to update it. That's true. New technical things you've got to be aware of. If people are in software development, it's just changing so fast. There's new languages you've got to keep up with. And we just say, well, that's the way it is. No, that's the way it is now, but that was not the way it was before computers and all that came on the scene. But that's the world we live in. Education is needed to find a good job today, but it doesn't mean to say it's 5 years at university. It just may mean that you've got to take a course where you've got to learn a skill, because you do have to have skills to live in today's world and to get a job in today's world. But too many young people enter long-term post-secondary education for the wrong reasons. Like, you know, the guidance teacher at school said to me that they thought I was cut out to be this or I'd be that, and you should go into this. You should, you know, see if you can get enrolled in this program at this university. They should not be making our decisions. What we should be doing is trying to help our young people in careers that can give them a job that pays a reasonable wage, for which they, when they go home, they don't bring it with them, for which they have the weekends free and for any other time they can have free. Because one of the greatest things to do is to have freedom of time. In Christadelphia, we need time free. We need time to travel. We need time to go to different cities to help different brethren be able to volunteer our time for projects around the ecclesia. And that's what everybody wants. It's interesting how, you know, industry looks at what we see in the Bible, that the ages of 30 to 50 are your most productive years, 30 to 50. Well, that's what the Bible said, maybe 20 to 50. But when you get to be 50, and you lose your job, and it may be because your job's not needed anymore, no one wants you. And when I started working, everybody had a retirement plan. Like when you worked, there was just automatic. Some of your wage went into retirement. Well, companies learned that's too expensive. We're not going to pay into these plans anymore, so that we'll hire people for a certain amount of time, and then after that, they can either get another contract with us or they can work for somebody else. But we're not going to pay into retirement. We're not going to pay maybe even into health plans. So young people getting into jobs today, which they don't have anything in the future for them at all. That's a very different world than what I grew up in. And I just happened to be very, very fortunate that in a school system, they still have a pension plan, or I wouldn't probably be here today. I'd be working somewhere. I have to work somewhere. You got to think about these things. It's just what the career you get into, getting into for the wrong reasons, means that you didn't really think it out properly to start with. And some education will attack our faith. You want to see that before you go to maybe where you actually stay as well as where you go to school. But just see how that will work out in life. I don't know if any of you know of the CMI, the Creation Ministries International. Anybody know that? The CMI is probably the most advanced group dealing with evolution. They're anti-evolutionists. They are Christian in the broad sense of Christian. They have a lot of false doctrines in terms of Christian, but they will really tackle evolution. And one of the things that they do provide is how well certain religions are doing with this. And they illustrate that even they and their religion, which is some kind of an evangelical group, are losing their young people. And that we are You know, people that are even creationists are generally losing this battle. But we don't have to lose it in terms of evolution if people can just find the education that they need. So too much of it leads to the wrong career for a brother or sister in the truth. And we just happen to notice that the Bible says in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 26, "You see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called." So when you go to an educational institution and they've got master's degrees and doctorate degrees and the rest of it, and that's how they talk, you've got to have these degrees to get along, you might just remember you won't find many people there that have been called by God, because that just seems to turn people the wrong way. And if they get into this evolution thing, it will because they will deny that God is their creator. Protecting yourself? Well, the world is designed to cater to the man and the woman without God. You see, this is where people who don't make any distinction between the world out there and us fail to understand that out there is a godless world. Now, there might be people who believe in God, but as far as we're concerned, if they don't believe in Yahweh, they don't believe in God. What is the difference? Well, many people need the confidence and security of life that God provides for people who read the book. Like, there's just all kinds of promises here. We put our trust in God because of those promises. So what does the man outside do? Well, he trusts in all the institutions of men to give him the same confidence. If we think that what people are doing outside is just something that we should do, we're failing to make that distinction, and we just gravitate to what they do. So, you know, when they want to find some security, they just go to people with money, and they generally find it around money one way or another. So the protection it offers is often what we would normally achieve through our faith in God. Don't let this world displace our patience and trust in the chastening of the Lord. So we will go through some chastening. We must expect that. So we don't try to sidestep every difficulty in life. And some of the ways that are the ways of faith are difficult, and they will involve in chastening. But chastening is for our benefit. In Psalm 50, verse 14, "Offer unto God thanksgiving and pay thy vows unto the Most High. Call upon me in the day of trouble. I will deliver thee, and thou shalt glorify me." And if you just keep that idea in mind, you just see how many times you have to make a distinction between what the world says and what we say. Now, I'll just give you one example of this. I don't know what, I told you this earlier, like I'm not sure everyone would agree with me on some of these things, and this is one of them. If you look at jobs that require you to join a union, you want to look into that union very carefully, because the union talks about a brotherhood, you know, the brotherhood of steel workers or brotherhood of coal workers or whatever it might be. They consider themselves a brotherhood. And what we want to do is create our brotherhood. Now, can you be in two brotherhoods? Can you share with the world and share with God? Can you actually do that? Well, that's where we find it. And in some cases, we think that protect ourselves would be to go to a job in a union that's more secure without understanding what that union stands for. I didn't realize this until in my second sort of stint at college teaching. I kept on getting these letters from the union that saying, "These are the demands that we make of the employer." I thought to myself, well, the Bible never talks about making demands of anybody. Why would we ever want to support something that demands that our employer increases our wages? We're supposed to be content with that. So you start to see this is out of keeping with the brotherhood that I already belong to. I can't belong to this brotherhood. Now, depending where your conscience is, that could force you right out of the job. See, I don't want this job any longer. And if you had thought about that to start with, you might never have got into that career for the fact that, no, there's a number of things in it that we have got no part with. But some brethren have gone that way, and you just have to understand that's the way it is. Lotteries. How would you like to win a lottery? One day, Dorothy and I were traveling down to the Ottawa Bible School, and we flew to Las Vegas and rented a car to drive down the canyon just to see the Grand Canyon and get down to there. And so we had to spend the night in Las Vegas. Well, I'd never had any experiences like that in my life, never knew anything about Las Vegas. But if you've ever been to Las Vegas, it's quite the city, and that's where gambling is uppermost. That's the city that has probably the greatest reputation for nightlife. And you even went into the airport. You get in the airport, and there's these gambling slot machines all through the airport. I wouldn't have thought they would have put it there, but they did. So they have these huge payouts worth tens of millions of dollars, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars today. It sometimes sounds so good. You imagine, set yourself to thinking about what you would do with that kind of money. I mean, that would be a major problem, ever trying to think of what you would ever do with money of that size. When associated with the benefits for charity, it sounds better. So in many cases, in Ontario at least, they have these lotteries that are associated with hospitals, and that's how a hospital raises their funds, by selling these tickets. And then they give you a $14 million house or something, which you couldn't even pay the taxes on or anything else. So it always is something that sounds so good, but if you read the fine print, no, there's nothing to it. So winning it would make our discipleship much more difficult. You see, 1 Timothy chapter 6 and 9 has said, "But they that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and hurtful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition." I can't see anything good about getting into a lot of money from what Paul had to tell Timothy about those who desire to be rich. And when you think of how did they ever get that amount of money for a lottery anyway, it's only at the backs of people that can't afford it that actually contributed to it. Now, this is our last one. I think social media. There might actually be one more than this. So social media, anything and everything is discussed by email, Facebook, and Twitter. I didn't really know much about Twitter until President Trump. And then I knew that Twitter must have something, because a lot of people seem to react to what's on it. Facebook, I have dabbled a little with Facebook. I really don't like it because it just takes a lot of time. And I never really found anything too useful on it for me anyway. Ecclesial problems are not solved by public opinion. Now, this is the problem area, and I think this is a major problem area we got to face with Facebook or with social media. Because we find that the whole philosophy of the Bible's organization of an ecclesia is at risk with this. Because the way we organize our meetings is we have arranging brethren, and we choose them. And they are set up to organize things for the ecclesia, and in many cases deal with difficult problems in the ecclesia. And it would never have been thought of a generation ago that young people would make the decisions of the ecclesia. But today, because you can so easily just make a post on Facebook and send it to all your friends and get all kinds of things back, and what amazed me, and it was a sad day when I found that some of the arranging brethren of an ecclesia I belonged to were actually on Facebook supporting a petition of a number of other people that the ecclesia wouldn't have agreed with. That is, how awkward could it be that people think that you can get the support of people on Facebook to override what the decision of the ecclesia is? No, it's just a matter of the world, isn't it? It's the majority that rules. It doesn't matter whether you're a member or not, but you're one of the people that contributed to signing this petition or something. That's not the way problems are to be solved. And the electronic media is just going and going and going. Who knows where that will actually end up. But the whole structure of the ecclesia is at risk through the use of social media. We want to really be careful we're not contributing to it. So 1 Timothy chapter 3 says, this is a true saying, "If a man desire the office of a bishop, he desireth a good work." Not a novice, Now, that's a little bit down, but it's saying that you don't qualify if you're a novice, lest being lifted up with pride, he fall into the condemnation of the devil. So there were a number of rules that were established of how people would qualify to be a leader of an ecclesia. And a person who didn't have any experience in it was to be rejected, not a novice. Because the likelihood is that being lifted up with pride and arrogance, he would fall into the condemnation, or he would get himself involved in things which weren't right. We got to be very careful. Young people, you have to watch that, because you're probably more into Facebook and social media than others are. And you have to be careful how you use it. If it's challenging the ecclesia, that's not right. That's not the structure that God gave. We do not want to be involved in it in that sense. So just going on with a few little closing comments here. This is the passage that the Pope got into and thought that he could correct the Bible, the King James Bible anyway, because he didn't believe that God leads people into temptation. As he said, that's the Satan's department. That's the way he put it. God does not lead us into temptation. Satan does. So the King James Bible needs to be revised to teach us, let us not fall into temptation. Because he said God doesn't lead anybody into temptation. God's a father, and he protects people. He doesn't understand the Bible. He doesn't understand the word used for lead or the word for temptation. And yet, I don't think there was any follow-up that I could see. I didn't see everything, but I couldn't see any follow-up from other religions or other groups that were saying the Pope is wrong. It just seems to be that's the way people treat comments. They don't put anything to them at all. Temptation of putting to the proof. God does prove us. He does try us. He does put us through situations where he's essentially purifying our character so that we will be better suited for the kingdom age. To say that God doesn't do it, and to say it's Satan's department, would be very difficult to explain how Paul delivered certain people unto Satan that they might learn not to blaspheme. Like, the man doesn't know his Bible. And how we would say that, I can't understand. And this is always a great one. I think this is really a very, very significant passage. One of these ones you want to put up on your wall. It says in Romans 13, verse 14, put on the Lord Jesus Christ, make no provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof. And you can think about that. So what that could mean in your life. But just as an example, if a person is an alcoholic, it would not be a good idea for them to stock up their home supply just in case they ever wanted to return to that lifestyle. You wouldn't do that, would you? If you wanted to avoid something, you wouldn't go out and provide for yourself. But there's a lot of ways that you can make provision for the flesh. And the carnal mind is so subtle sometimes in the way it gets us thinking that we can't tell that it is really a provision for the flesh. That's why we should delay making decisions. And maybe if we think about something, let it rest for the night. And in the morning, have another look at it. And usually with that little bit of time, that extra time, we can get over these errors where we have made provision for the flesh. So in many avenues of life, our survival depends upon a commitment to total abstinence. That's our survival. We are a purchased people. We don't ever want to become again entangled and overcome by what we have left behind. As he says, the latter end of them is worse with them than the beginning. That's 2 Peter 2, verse 20. We have been purchased. We're not our own. After we're baptized, we're purchased. We have been, a price has been paid for us to be the sons and daughters of God, lest we go back to be to the master of sin. The purchasing involved the agony of the agonizing death of the one we now call our Lord. So we'd never want to just consider that as something that we could despise and reject. The purchase price involved us becoming slaves to a new and a kind master. God has done that for our good. So we need to honor that arrangement. Now, I want to leave it there. And tomorrow, Lord willing, I want to look at, in the morning, as I think I mentioned to you, we want to look at a couple examples from the Scripture. They're pretty large examples, just to see how people got into covetousness, what God thought about it, and what happened to them as a result of it. I think there's three of them, because they're fairly big, but it's a very, very good setting to remember this whole problem of covetousness. Thank you.